from the north and the south to the beautiful land. Commentary for the March 21st, 2020 Sabbath School lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry. Further visual aids and footnotes can be found at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com with the written version of this commentary. Now then I tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Daniel 11, verse 2. Daniel chapter 11 is central to the Hebrew addition to the Aramaic portion of Daniel. Chapter 8 was the glue intended to fasten the two portions together. Chapters 9 and 10 are the introduction to the justification for the Maccabean revolt. Chapter 11 is a historical and prophetic justification, and Daniel chapter 12 is a denouement for this section and ostensibly for the entire book, although there are two more chapters that were not included in our modern Protestant Bibles. The intro to this chapter takes us directly into the succession of the Achaemenid kings. The Achaemenids being called that because they are descended from the mythological heroic ruler Achaemenes. There is no positive verification extant as to whether Achaemenes ever really existed, or if so, when. Darius I claims descent from him, but rulers previous to him do not make mention of such descent. Nonetheless, the lineage is labeled after him for ease of historical reference. Seventh-day Adventists have long held with Uriah Smith's 19th century commentary regarding this lineage. Smith identifies the fourth king after Cyrus as Xerxes. While he is Cyrus II and not Cyrus I, he is the founder of an Achaemenid empire based upon his conquests of Media, Lydia, and Babylon, and therefore is a more likely candidate to trace that lineage from. Cyrus I, a predecessor, was instead an unassuming vassal to the Medes. When we trace the kings after Cyrus II, also known as Cyrus the Great, through Cambyses II, Bardia or Smerdis, and Darius I, we end up with Xerxes I. Xerxes has special meaning for the Jews, because it is from his reign that the festival of Purim, or casting lots, arose, a story we know today as the Book of Esther. While most Jewish festivals derive from the Pentateuch, Purim and Hanukkah celebrate events that took place between the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem and the incarnation of the Messiah. It is significant, therefore, that this chapter then should bring us to the reign that gave us Purim, providing spiritual support for the Maccabees, who later gave us Hanukkah. If we are to find any sort of encapsulation for this narrative within the Hebrew portion of Daniel to match the chiasm in the Aramaic portion, it might be through the implied historical importance of the deliverance of the Jews on Purim and the cleansing of the sanctuary of the first Hanukkah. While this structure brings us to the Maccabees, it also revives perhaps this foundation for that contemporary struggle, the age-old battles with Israel's sometimes friends, but more often enemies, to the north and south. The north brought struggles against the Syrians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, while the south brought large Egyptian armies into Palestine, the Pleasant Land. Although both are ruled by Greeks descended from Seleucus in the north and Ptolemy in the south during the Maccabean era, little has changed for the Jews, as they had done to survive somehow in the buffer zone between them. They continued to attempt to play off the two powerful antagonists against each other. However, as this chapter of Daniel makes clear, the Jews could do little to moderate, much less stop, the ongoing conflict between the two powers that considered Palestine their rightful prize. Ultimately, the narrative in Maccabees 1 and 2 tells us the Jews took up their own fight and set about attempting to carve out once again a restoration of the divinely enlightened monarchies of David and Solomon. I will not detail the various intrigues, battles, and treaties alluded to in this chapter, as they are already well documented in Uriah Smith's book, previously mentioned. Where he and I diverge may be of more significance. This is in the interpretation of the robbers of thy people as Rome and the Roman Empire. Others equate this with the Seleucid and Macedonian empires of the north, conspiring to take Palestine and all other Egyptian territories from a young ruler in Egypt. They were thwarted in their conspiracy by the intervention of Rome, which made Egypt a protectorate. This was an important lesson for the Maccabees, who would later use the same ploy against the Seleucids, with the Seleucid Empire crumbling under pressure from Rome. The Hasmonean lineage, descended from the Maccabees, rose to rule over Palestine. But Rome, stepping into the power vacuum left by the fall of the Seleucids, conquered Palestine as well, eventually setting up the Herodians, Edomite converts to Judaism, to replace the Hasmoneans as proxies for Rome. When you offer a powerful dog a treat, as the Hasmoneans did with offering Rome to the Seleucids, one must be wary lest the dog take the hand holding the treat as well. It was during the reign of Herod Antipas that Jesus was born and crucified. During Christ's lifetime, Herodians and Roman governors ruled jointly in Palestine. This is why Jesus was bounced back and forth between Pontius Pilate and Herod Antipas before his crucifixion. Uriah Smith really does not deal with the Maccabees in his book. Perhaps he did not consider them to be a significant player during the intertestamental period. Or maybe he simply failed to account for them because Protestant Bibles ignored that period for the most part, with only the book of Esther speaking to the period after the restoration of the temple. Even today, most Protestants consider Esther an interesting story of faith, but not doctrinally significant. While it is sometimes a subject of children's stories, adult Protestants rarely give much attention to the book, the gruesome ending making it even difficult to share with their children. The fact that God is not mentioned in the book also seems to make it into more of a fairy tale about a powerful prince, a beautiful princess, and a wicked royal advisor than an important doctrinal text. Whether Smith cares about the Maccabees or not, he and I agree on one thing. The closing of the intertestamental period leaves Rome in charge in Palestine. However, from this point onward, as with several other commentators, pure speculation begins. Looking through history, Smith seeks events that might support a particular verse and strings them together, rather arbitrarily, asserting that an event that occurs several centuries later is a historical equivalent to the verse without regard to the possibility of applications more contemporary to the Maccabean, Herodian, and Roman interaction. It is as though, although the Jewish people in Jerusalem had been significant throughout the Old Testament and the intertestamental period, they were now relegated to the dustbin of history. One might see this as a final rejection of Judaism, as represented by the stoning of Stephen and the selection by God of Paul as an apostle to the Gentiles. But then that raises other questions. Why would the biblical focus be entirely on Rome, as some have interpreted the books of Daniel and Revelation to be? Why is there absolute silence about other great empires, such as the Mongols, the Chinese, or the Ottomans? One might make an argument that these were not Christian, so the Bible ignores them. Obviously, even Uriah Smith was troubled by that idea because he sought a place for the Ottomans in his interpretation of Revelation. But still, suppose we did buy into that perspective. We even then could rightfully wonder why the Rus or the British were not mentioned. Both were Christian empires, the British Empire even spanning the entire globe. Yet no place is found for it in the procession to the apocalypse. Strangely, though, perhaps because Seventh-day Adventism arose in an American context, we have made every effort to insert the United States as a main ingredient into the apocalyptic stew, albeit unfavorably. Perhaps it belongs there, but is it more deserving than other major empires, past or present? Sometimes we American Christians tend to come across as self-absorbed and indifferent to the rest of the world. We settle on our peculiar perspective on the Bible and the world's relevance to it, and incorporating our peculiar perspective into a statement of doctrinal orthodoxy, we no longer search further for understanding. After all, if we have the truth, what need is there for anything more? We become so settled in our perspective, backed up by majority votes and published decrees, that ossification sets in. There is no need to consider anything further except to recite perpetually what we have already decided to be the truth. God have mercy on any who would question such a stand. Historically, mankind has not been kind to those who might question orthodoxy, or even worse, those that might question Christianity's endorsement of a particular political party. Vicious personal epithets at times reveal that were it still legal, there would still be many Christs crucified and left for the life to drain out of them, with their accusers feeling the world was a better place for it. Why do we find it so difficult to accept the idea that truth is progressive? Why can't we continue to search for and find further pearls hidden in Scripture, hidden deeper than those who came before us were willing or able to go? That can set us free from the paralysis so many have been willing to accept in exchange for that freedom. Thank you for listening to this commentary. Again, more commentaries can be found at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com.